As traditional sources of energy are depleted, there's a global need for affordable and sustainable energy. And here in Wisconsin, we have some world-class research going on to respond to that. And great to have a couple of people with me today, a couple of those experts with us today, to talk about some aspects of the research that's going on with the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. And zeroing in today on bioenergy crop trials, things that are going on there. And I'm kind of interested to learn what they're doing in that area, and I hope you are as well. And you may have some questions for them as we move along today. The number to call with your question, 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mehler Show. You can post a question or a comment as well to our guest today. John Greenler has been with us a whole bunch of times. John is Director of Education and Outreach Programs for the GLBRC. Always a pleasure, John. Thanks for coming by.
It's great to be back once again. Thanks, Larry.
Greg Sanford with us as well, PhD scientist with the GLBRC and manager of the bioenergy crop trials at the University of Wisconsin Arlington Research Station. And Greg, great to have you back as with us as well.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
Well, first of all, crop trials. What the heck goes on at a crop trial? John?
Actually, I'm going to pass it to Greg. No worries.
Go to Greg first? Okay.
Sure. Great question. The crop trials that are going on at Arlington and actually in southwestern Wisconsin at the Kellogg Biological Research Station were initiated really to look at how many of the potential bioenergy systems that we're looking at are going to affect things like soil carbon, water quality, how much biomass can we generate from these different crops. And so Arlington's a good place to do that. It's centrally located. We have a great crew up there, and KBS is an additional great research station to be doing that kind of work.
Yeah, I love that station. It's been beautiful. Many times there. If you were going to describe its location, you think in terms of Madison, it's what, how many miles north? Almost straight north, isn't it, of Madison?
Mm-hmm. It's about 40 miles north of Madison, right at the Dane County, Columbia County border there, kind of right where the Empire Prairie used to be. So these are all rich, deep mollusols that we're growing crops on up there.
Some of the best soils you'll find anywhere.
Yeah. Does that have some impact on the trials themselves, the fact that we've got this great soil?
Absolutely. In fact, we not just for bioenergy trials, but any crops, we sometimes get some flack for doing research on what might not be exactly representative of the rest of the state. But it does show what the potential for crops are. The soils mm-hmm. are quite uniform, so it enables a little bit more experimental rigor. But we do need to go off station to get at how these bioenergy systems are gonna work under less than ideal conditions. And in fact, Kellogg Biological Station in Southwest Michigan, where we have similar trials, is a good kind of step in that direction. Mm-hmm. It's a much sandier, coarser soil, so we're working on those soils as well.
Yeah, okay. The trials are actually mirror replicates, and it's very interesting to kind of compare the data from the Michigan site with the Wisconsin site. Frequently get very different data and really gain some really important understandings in terms of how these crops grow in different types of conditions, especially soil. It can just mean all the difference.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, I would think so. John Greenler and Greg Sanford from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Our guest today, Greg, is with us for the first time. He is the manager of the bioenergy crop trials at the Arlington Research Station. So great to have him back, and certainly always nice to have John come by as well. You may want to join in with a question or comment for them on the work that they're doing. Give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. These crop trials, typically, are they 1 year? How many years do they run?
That's a great question. So for many of these systems that we're looking at in terms of biomass production, whether it's for cellulosic ethanol or combustion, heat generation, those types of things, we're interested in perennial crops. And so 1 year, 2 year trials really aren't enough to get an idea of the yield potential of some of the crops, their effect on the environment. And so the trials that we're talking about today have been in place now for 5 years, will be in place for at least an additional 5 years. What we discuss often in the agronomy department here at the UW is data gets better and better. The story gets a little bit clearer as we're able to push those trials longer. So some of the best trials right now in the state are 20, 30, 50-year trials.
Wow.
Where we can really get a handle on some of the trends and how the environment is impacting those various different things.
So we've got crops out there that we've had on trial for 50 years?
Yes, at the Arlington Research Station, the soils department has some corn trials looking at the impact of fertilizer on corn that have been in the place for 50 years. There are a number of cropping systems trials that have been in place for 20 to 30 years. So those would include corn, soybeans, alfalfa, forages, pasture, those types of things. And then the bioenergy systems, we're kind of not getting started in terms of research, but getting started in terms of large systems trials, and we're hoping to keep those around just as long. So,
what kinds of crops are you working on with in the bioenergy area?
That's a great question. When we set out to run these trials at Arlington and KBS, the idea was to look at a range of potential crops, things that people are looking at, not necessarily everything that people that's being looked at, but kind of different functional systems. So we have everything from our continuous annual crop systems like corn, and then all the way to a diverse prairie system. So the way things are laid out, they're laid out along gradients of perenniality. So we have annual and perennial systems. We have forbs and grass systems, so broadleaf and grass systems. We have woody and herbaceous systems. And so if we were to walk through all of the species we're looking at, we've got the typical annuals, corn and corn and soybeans. We have monoculture switchgrass, which has been kind of the poster child for the bioenergy revolution. Then we have a monoculture grass called Miscanthus giganteus, which is a sterile hybrid of two native South Asian grasses.
Big grass.
Very tall. On a good year, it'll be 12 feet tall. And then we have a monoculture woody short rotation poplar. So this is a hybrid poplar. We've also got various mixtures of the native grasses, kind of moving away from a monoculture of switchgrass into more of a polyculture. We have, of course, our high diversity prairie, which was abundant in the southern part of Wisconsin prior to agricultural activities in the state. And then we actually have a treatment that's just weeds. We tilled it when we started the trial and walked away and said, well, how much biomass can we generate without paying anything for seed or anything for fertilizer? And
We just
let it grow.
Some years it's been a winner, too, and the data's really interesting.
You're kidding. No.
The first year in particular, breaking a sod and letting the seed bank come to life, we generated quite a bit of biomass, over two tons or close to 2 tons an acre. And it's gone downhill. This year it was not a winner, but, you know, we also didn't pay anything to get that biomass. So,
oh, man. Talking with John Greenler and Greg Sanford. As we visit with them about bioenergy crop trials, what we can learn from them, and certainly looking forward to hearing what you have to say, too. So give us a call, 1-800-642-1234. Arlington, you're going through all these trials and listing all the various things that you're doing. My golly, I knew it was a good-sized place, but how many acres are we talking about here?
I might get this wrong, but I'll be within a couple hundred. I think we have about 2,200 acres. There's a lot of research going on there. Horticulture, agronomy, plant pathology. You know, there's just a number of very neat things going on there in dairy science. So.
Yeah, there's even a herd of sheep up there, if I recall.
That's
properly,
right. Yeah.
So it's sort of a special relationship. Explain how this works. It's owned by the University of Wisconsin, I guess.
Yeah, that's correct. And, it was a it was a really important component of our starting up the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center to actually have these trials there. It's about the soil, but it's also about, you know, being integrated into this agricultural research. It's such a rich part of the university's history, and all the management skills and the integration with the other projects that are up there is really been a phenomenal opportunity for us. And, you know, the history, you just kind of, you get up there and you can just feel the wealth of the history and knowledge that mm-hmm. we have in terms of agriculture and farming here in Wisconsin and through the university.
So it's a place that's like 40 minutes away from Madison, so university researchers have pretty quick and easy access.
That's right. It's very easy to access. In addition to what John was saying, it's great to work up there. The crew is phenomenal. Darwin, Matt Repking, all of the people working up there and managing it do a great job of facilitating the scientific research. And then the guys running the tractors and planting and harvesting are all fun to be with. And it's great to actually be able to sit and shoot ideas back and forth about, well, you know, this is really interesting research, but would a farmer ever do this? And so that's always a good conversation to have.
Yeah. And then, like, during the growing season, there's, like, a caravan of, you know, student assistants or whatnot that drive up there every day that get all the work done, because a lot of the data collection, you know, that we're talking about other programs is really intensive. So there's a lot of people up there, especially during the summer, during that growing season. It's pretty impressive. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you get these 24-hour sampling runs. People are camped out up there overnight, you know, trying to get the data at just the right point in time so we can really understand the full dynamics of these crops. You know, when is CO2 being released or taken up by these plants? Very fundamental and important questions.
Hmm. Karen in Platteville has a question for you. Hi, Karen.
Good morning.
Morning.
Morning, Karen.
I'm wondering why the fields up in the former Empire Prairie, to which you referred earlier up near Arlington, are so often plowed in the fall and left without a cover crop over the winter, because it seems to me that there's a lot of soil erosion when that happens. So I'm just wondering if you could address that.
You know, we can address that, but and we will, but we need to take a quick look at the news and the weather first. So I've got that. We've got that noted.
Let's cue that up and we'll come back to it.
Karen, and we will we'll come back to that right after we take a quick look at the news, weather, find out what else is in store for us here on the IdeasNet, and visiting today with John Greenler and Greg Sanford. You stay with us. As our traditional sources of energy are depleted, the global need for affordable and sustainable energy, and right here in Wisconsin, we have some world-class research going on to respond to that. Larry Mueller here, so glad to have you along today on the Ideas Network. Talking today with folks from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center to talk about some new developments in the search for cleaner and renewable energy. John Greenler and Greg Sanford are staffers at the center, and with us to talk about kind of what goes on behind the scenes in the way of research at the UW Arlington Research Station. They're with us until 12:30. Happy to answer your questions when you call in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Leave a question or comment on my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And if you click like while you're there, we'll send you regular updates on upcoming show topics. We'll be back with our guests right after the news. Well, as a country and a planet, we use predominantly more traditional forms of fuel. There's a lot of exciting research going on to move us toward more cleaner, more renewable sources, and some of that cutting-edge work happens right here at the UW-Madison. John Greenler is the Director of Education and Outreach Programs for the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center with me in the studio. Great to have you back, John.
Thanks, Larry. Good to be here.
And Greg Sanford is a PhD scientist with GLBRC and the manager of the bioenergy crop trials at Arlington. And Greg, thanks for spending time with us today. Appreciate it very much.
Nice to be here, Larry.
We've had questions, and we have some open lines, by the way, if you'd like to join in with your own questions as we talk with them about these bioenergy crops and the crop trials that are going on, give us a call 1-800-642-1234 or go to my Facebook page. You can post there at the Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. Karen posted and wondered about, she's actually from Platteville, but has had chances to obviously to drive by the Arlington Farms, 40 miles north of Madison or so, where a lot of this research takes place, noting that you'll see a lot of fall plowing and there's no cover to some of the land, wondering why that happens.
Yeah, Karen, that's a great question. There's a number of reasons that people plow in the fall. One is that in Wisconsin, where we tend to have cold, wet springs, sometimes it's actually difficult to get in if people are using tillage for seedbed preparation. It's sometimes difficult to get into the spring and do that tillage. Farmers also like or discuss how fall tillage tends to break up the season soil and then give the winter some time to work at it and mellow it, kind of through freeze thaw action. But you're absolutely right that concerns over soil erosion or actually loss of that soil's carbon through oxidation is something we think about a lot. And so there are some solutions to that. Getting a cover crop in on time is a great idea if we can do that. I think some farmers are maybe hesitant to do that because it does in some ways complicate the rotation a little bit. For corn, if you're taking corn off as grain, you have a pretty small window in the fall to get anything growing. If you were taking something off earlier like wheat, it's much easier to do. And then in the spring, you have to deal with that cover crop. You could harvest it and use it as a forage, or if you were going to till it back in, you could till it and use it kind of as a green manure. We are at the GLBRC, where we do have some annual corn grain systems for biofuel purposes. We have begun using a wheat and rye and Austrian winter pea cover in that to see if we can keep something growing in those annual systems and kind of move our annual systems more towards behaving like perennials. So keeping the soil covered all the time, making sure that we're putting as much carbon below ground in that root structure as possible. Those types of things. John, did you want to throw anything in there?
Yeah, the other thing I was just going to add is this is a good example of one of the advantages of some of these perennial systems that we're looking at for bioenergy crops, because of the fact that they're there year round.
Yeah.
They'll be green, well into the fall and that holds the soil down. It's also significant in terms of our capturing energy from sunlight. If that field is green, it's photosynthetically active, and we're actually being able to take advantage of that ultimate energy source, the sun, for making biomass that we can then convert into fuels. And so, the perennial crops bring that naturally, and then we're actually even, working on some breeding programs to see if we can enhance that to the greatest extent possible to get as much of that solar energy captured into that plant biomass.
Very cool. Very cool. Mike in Ferryville has a question. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi. Mike, it's like a two-part question. One is, I was doing some research, trying to do some research on small home heat generating systems and electrical generating systems. I came across a company that does commercial scale power generation using biomass. And it's a German company. But I guess they're also based in the States, and they make a type of pellet out of biomass that they also sell. But they said their system could run either wood, like chips or so forth, or this pellet. Have you done any research along those lines with a pelleted type material from this biomass? And did you hear of their system, which is supposed to be very efficient because they generate power not off the backside but off the gas produced from that combustion?
Yeah. John Greenler, I said, go ahead.
Yeah, there's a number of different ways of looking at that. One that is a little more challenging to consider. But in terms of the overall kind of energy systems that we're looking at, one of our biggest challenges is the connection between our energy we use for transportation and where we get that energy. At this point in time, we're largely locked in to petroleum products, to oil, for moving things around. So in GLBRC, our main focus is on the liquid transportation fuels because we have so few alternatives at this point in time in terms of how to drive, how to fuel cars, trucks, planes, barges, etc. And so the liquid transportation issue is really paramount for us. And biofuels, liquid biofuels, is probably one of our best considerations for that. When we look at renewable energy sources and electricity, we do have alternatives. So clearly there's a lot of really significant developments that are being made on the solar photovoltaic front. Wind turbines are becoming a significant source of electricity here in the Midwest. And so, you know, we really try and look at the big picture in our research portfolio in terms of what's most pressing and where do we want to use what type of energy source most. That said, there are definitely opportunities and considerations that are valuable in terms of bioenergy for combustion, for heat, or for electricity, some of these more small-scale type enterprises. And pelletizing biomass has a lot of value in terms of the fact that it densifies it, which makes it easier to transport and to store as well. And there actually are some really interesting local efforts to even pelletize switchgrass, for example. At this point in time, I think it's mainly being used for home and small commercial heating use. Agricol is an interesting company just south of Madison, actually, that's kind of pioneered that for their work. They actually grow a lot of native grasses. But there are other similar efforts. And then, you know, if we look at developing countries as well and the opportunities and the needs that they have, rural electrification, I think, is a big opportunity. And this is true in Europe as well. Germany, which the caller mentions, is very innovative in a lot of these biofuel systems. I haven't heard specifically about the project that the caller mentions, but for example, they're very innovative in their use of livestock waste, cow manure, etc., and the anaerobic fermentation to make methane, and using that not just for electrical generation, but actually even cleaning up to the point where they can actually pipe it around the country for use in, you know, residential heating and cooking, for example. So there's a broad diversity. The big challenge is looking at what's the most pressing need and what are the best local opportunities, resources available to solve a particular energy problem.
Thanks for that call. Appreciate it very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 as we visit with John Greenler and Greg Sanford from the Great Lakes Bioenergy Research Center. Paul in Kenosha has a question for you guys, so let's go to Paul. Hi, Paul. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you. I have some questions related to weed control. How do you control the weeds in these various biomass crops? And I'm sure that varies depending upon the crop, if they're perennials and so forth. And then for that plot where you just let it go to weeds, did you have any concern about spreading weed seeds and make any controls there? And giant ragweed a possible biomass plant, perchance?
Yep. Okay, let's go to Greg first.
Paul, these are great questions. You're absolutely right that the bioenergy crop in question is going to determine what weed control you can and can't use. For example, when we're talking about growing prairies, with the idea of using them for biomass, we're really quite limited. Our hands are tied unless there is a particular weed that you don't want in there, such as Canada thistle or something, and you're willing to go to the lengths of walking around and trying to control it with something like stinger. But for some of the other energy crops, I'm going to keep kind of defaulting on switchgrass and miscanthus, mm-hmm. just because they're kind of the two big hitters here. There's a lot that you can do. A number of agronomists suggest that if you are planning to seed switchgrass, It's best to do it following something like a soybean crop where you had really good weed control. So if you were using a Roundup Ready soybean and your field was really clean, or if you were using a conventional soybean without that Roundup Ready gene and you were able to keep a clean field, going into a clean field is going to be the first your first defense. Any kind of burn down activity, spring burn down with glyphosate or something like that would be very helpful. But with things like switchgrass, we typically spend a year letting that crop get established. So switchgrass spends most of its first year putting down a good root system and getting ready to go. So in that first year, weed control might actually include mowing or clipping that biomass just to keep unwanted weeds from going to seed. And then in the second year, if you've gotten a good stand going, you can come in typically early before that switchgrass breaks dormancy. When we start to see the crowns just starting to spike, at the point when that plant doesn't have any photosynthetically active tissue, you can actually hit the fields with Roundup and get an early burn down on it. But ideally, once switchgrass or miscanthus get established, if you can hold the crop in there for the first year, it tends to be so competitive with other things in the field that you really don't need to worry too much. There might be some problem weeds in specific areas. As far as the weed field you mentioned, that's a great question that I've been kind of asking myself every season since we started it. We have not put any protections in place as far as getting weeds in our other fields. It is a concern, and we're very vigilant, but we do see some pretty noxious weeds showing up. We've got quite a lot of Canada thistle in those fields. We do have a lot of giant ragweed, which I assume could work as a bioenergy crop, but as John maybe can talk to, when we start talking about things, these tall, fibrous crops like giant ragweed or industrial hemp or some of the other things that might come along, we're talking about annual crops. So even if they look very productive in terms of total biomass, there are some concerns when we start moving out of perenniality for biomass production.
Hmm.
Yeah, it's really striking when you go out to these fields, and even this year we had a very hot, dry year, and actually we had some students out about a little over a month ago, and you know the students were actually allowed to walk into a couple of these plots, and you know after they moved in 10 feet, you can't see them. I mean, they're the switchgrass, the miscanthus is over their head, and it's just so thick. There's so much biomass that functionally it really completely outcompetes a lot of these weeds once it gets established. And this gets back to the value of perenniality in these crops is that you can really decrease a lot of the inputs that are necessary to maintain them. And that means that translates into something that's more ecologically friendly and also a crop that requires a lot less energy. So every time you talk about fertilizer or irrigation or weed management, pest management, you're talking about energy inputs. And all the energy inputs mean that on a net basis, we're getting less energy out. And so we get really excited when we can see these really efficient systems working so well.
And Paul, thanks again. Appreciate your call. We had a Facebook question from William who wonders, why can't they use the whole corn stalk? I see fields and fields of these giant rolls of gathered stalks. And Greg Sanford, do you want to start with that?
I'm going to actually pass it off to John here.
All right, John Greenler.
Yeah, so excellent observation. And the answer is yes. You know, we're really looking forward to being able to use a lot of that biomass that remains after the farmers have harvested the grain. The grain actually amazingly makes up about half of the above ground biomass of a corn plant, but we're still left with that other half. It's very critical that a portion of that, what we call corn stover, everything but the grain, the stalks, the stems, the leaves, etc., the cob, it's really critical that a portion of that go back into the soil or something equivalent to it. And that's where a cover crop might come in. But we can take a significant amount of that very fibrous material, which is really largely composed of this polymer we call cellulose, which is really just sugar kind of beads on a string. And so a lot of our research is looking at exactly how do we break down that fibrous material to get to the sugars that we can then use to make biofuel, whether it be ethanol or biodiesel or any jet fuel, et cetera. So, you know, and I'm really, you know, pleased to report that, you know, there are major breakthroughs being made. We're seeing the ground being broken on the first commercial scale biofuel plants that will actually be using corn stover for making you know large amounts of biofuel in the next years, couple of years.
Don in Warren, Illinois, your turn. Hi, Don.
Hi. When years ago we had pure stands and idle ground of Indian hemp, ditchweed, marijuana. Has anybody tested that? Our representative wanted to try and test grow this for fiber, and they said no, that's marijuana, you can't touch that. So I just wondered if anybody had been into that field.
Okay, Greg Sanford.
Don, great question. I'll let John a little bit later answer whether or not he knows if anybody's testing it. I'm sure it's being looked at globally. I don't know that a lot of that research is being done in the U.S. Do you know?
I think that, you know, the big consideration when it comes to hemp is that it is an annual crop. And once again, you know, this gets back to this net efficiency, what we call life cycle assessment, how much material, energy, et cetera, needs to go in versus what you get out. Also, kind of in a more common lexicon, we call it kind of, you know, cradle to grave, or in the biofuels world, plow to pump. So how much energy does it take to get the crop versus the energy that you're going to get out? And anytime you're dealing with an annual crop, you're having to plow, you're having to seed, lots more irrigation, weed management, et cetera. And so, you know, the analysis just indicates that we're much better off looking at these perennial crops. If you're going to plant a dedicated biofuel crop, you're much better looking at these perennials like switchgrass. You know, if you already have corn stover as a residue from the production of the grain, you know, that's a whole different ballgame. That's a material which is, you know, already, you know, of a low value. That's an opportunity that you don't want to waste. But if we're going to plant a crop specifically for bioenergy, these perennial crops are a much better bet in a fundamental way.
Makes sense. Thanks, Don, for calling. Ron in Newburgh, hello to you.
Yes, with regard to switchgrass and some of these other products that you would plant just for biomass versus corn, do you have any figures at all on the pounds per acre that can be grown, or handier yet would be the BTUs per acre on each one of those crops?
Yeah, Ron, thanks for the question. I don't have the BTU numbers in front of me right now, but for something like switchgrass, you know, there are two kind of general classes or categories of switchgrass. The ones that have typically been grown in the upper Midwest are upland type switchgrasses. There's a lowland switchgrass, which is grown, further in the south. The reason we don't tend to grow it here is because, we currently don't have a lot of winter hardy germplasm. Mike Kassler in the agronomy department in USDA is doing a lot of work trying to develop winter hardy lowland varieties. But that being said, with the upland varieties of switchgrass, once you get it established, in a good year, you can probably get 3.5 to 5 tons of biomass. You know, depending on what the rain situation is, how fertile or infertile your soils are, something like miscanthus, you know, you could on a good year easily get between 5 and maybe 10 tons per acre. It's quite a bit of biomass.
Corn is about how much?
Well, that changes year by year, but I would say you could get 2.5 or 3 tons of corn stover easily a year, still leaving a little bit of residue on the field. But again, that goes back to the fact that, you know, with corn, you've got kind of a dual purpose thing there. If you're taking the grain off, you have cattle feed, or I guess it could be processed into ethanol from starch, but then you've also got a cellulosa component. The main drawback, as John's alluded to repeatedly, is that you know, corn is an annual, and so while using corn stover is a nice kind of added benefit from growing a corn crop, these other things like switchgrass, miscanthus, some of the other native grass systems, and there's a lot of different grasses being looked at, have the benefit of being perennial. So that soil is being held in place. We're putting carbon below ground. Those plants are ready to go to utilize as much of the growing season as possible.
Mm. And yeah, go ahead.
I know we're probably going to run out of time here, but I did just want to mention one other important dimension to this consideration, and that is that when we're looking at planting these dedicated bioenergy crops, you know, I think the opportunity that we see as being most sustainable is to look at what we call marginal land. So these are agricultural mm-hmm. lands where it really isn't appropriate or desirable to be planting annual crops, you know, that we would use for food, such as corn or beans. And so even though the yield may not be as high on some of these marginal lands because the soil isn't of as high a quality, it means that we can get away from this food versus fuel issue, which is so fundamental. We really want to make sure that we're not diminishing our food production. And so the yield may go down, but it's use of land that really, you know, in a sustainable way that can't be used otherwise.
And with that, we have to close. Greg Sanford, John Greenler, thank you so much for being with us today. I really appreciate it. We'll have them on again in a couple of months, and we'll talk some more. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network.